Hey, Insiders. Preet here. So after Anne and I recorded our show early this morning, news broke that Postmaster General Louis DeJoy, who had begun carrying out several controversial changes to U.S. Postal Service operations, will delay the remaining changes until after the November election. In a statement, DeJoy said that the USPS would suspend plans to change retail hours, to decommission mail sorting machines, to remove mailboxes, to close processing facilities, and to cut overtime hours. DeJoy's reversal comes after days of public pressure and outcry over whether USPS will be able to handle the expected surge in mail-in ballots this November due to the COVID-19 pandemic. It's important to note that many changes have already been implemented, and it's not clear to me, from the statement, that those will be rolled back. Anne and I will be watching DeJoy's testimony before Congress next Monday, and we'll bring you more on the story as it continues to develop. In the meantime, here's our conversation from this morning, to help folks understand what led to this outcry over the United States Postal Service and to DeJoy's partial reversal.
From CAFE, welcome to CAFE Insider. I'm Preet Bharara.
And I'm Ann Milgram.
How are you, Ann?
Hey, Preet. Happy
August.
Happy August.
Did you catch any of the Democratic National Convention day one?
I did. I was preparing for the podcast, and in the background, I heard a Bruce Springsteen song, which caught
there
my
two.
Attention. I didn't hear two. I only heard the rising.
Well, then they had snippets of My City of Ruins, where he says, rise up. So a little confusion. We'll have to clear that up for folks.
Yeah. And then I watched Michelle Obama. I did not get a chance to watch a lot of the other folks. How about you?
Yeah, so I watched the whole thing. I was also reading some materials relating to the terrific United States Postal Service that we'll talk about this morning. Yeah, look, I thought it was somewhat mixed. You miss an audience. Some people can pull it off. Some people can't. There was this weird aerial view at one point of John Kasich, former Republican governor.
I saw a picture of that. I guess he was going to be at the crossroads.
He was in a field. I don't know.
Yeah,
what the
I didn't
going
understand
it.
Yeah. Okay.
But Michelle Obama, as I tweeted last night, was
she was phenomenal.
I think she's one of the best communicators, if not the best communicator in the country today, because the degree of difficulty in doing it from sitting in a chair without an audience, without a crowd, is high.
And looking like you're actually talking to someone. Yeah, it felt like an intimate conversation with her and that she was talking to each of us. And that's a pretty amazing thing to be able to pull off remotely.
Donald Trump is the wrong president for our country. He has had more than enough time to prove that he can do the job, but he is clearly in over his head. He cannot meet this moment. He simply cannot be who we need him to be for us. It is what it is.
Yeah, I think Barack wants a couple of days in between his speech and her speech.
Totally. Well, I actually said to my husband, she talked about Joe Biden and his personal story, which is a very compelling personal story, in a way that was far more connected, far more even than he does, right? Which is a very fascinating thing to be able to, you know, she's a very good storyteller, but she also comes across as very authentic. And I think that's, you know, I believed her when she said she hated politics. There are a few lines in there, and
yeah,
I felt she was really authentic. Hands down,
I think. Then the bit about the Amtrak and Joe Biden taking the train every day and getting to know the conductors and their testimonials. I mean, I thought that portion was very moving. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, I wouldn't have guessed some months ago that we would be spending much of an hour talking about the United States Postal Service. And yet here we are. Let me start the discussion this way. There's been a lot of concern, worry, some might say panic about things going on with the post office, the postal service. And I am not yet certain whether we're at a DEFCON 1 situation or a DEFCON 4 situation. And part of the reason for that, and we've discussed this on other occasions, is even when there is a legitimate, rational basis for doing something in this administration, whether it's relating to law enforcement or something else, they never explain, they never put out reasons. They seldom show up to testify about it. And the president himself says things that lead you to believe that the most nefarious thing possible is happening. And that's why Nancy Pelosi has called back the Congress for an emergency session to vote on legislation and to have a hearing. That's why people are up in arms. That's why there are protests happening outside of the home of the Postmaster General. Do you think we should be as alarmed as we sound and as people suggest?
So let me say that we get a lot of listener questions, and I'll read one of them in a second, but we got a lot on this subject. So I am concerned about it, and I think I'm not the only one who is wondering what's happening and how to make sure that there isn't a problem. And so I do worry a little bit that we all follow the next shiny thing. And right now it does appear to be the Postal Service and what's happening there. And I think it's really important that we focus on it and we talk about it today, but that we not lose sight of all the other voting issues as well. I mean, this is just one piece of a bigger conversation. And of course, we have to remember that the whole world is different because we're in the midst of a pandemic and because we're switching from a system where some people vote by absentee ballot or use mail-in votes. But we're switching from that to an estimate now of 60% of Americans will vote by mail this election. And that's unprecedented. And so there's a lot that's moving. But I do think personally that there's reason to be concerned. And I'll just read a question from one of our listeners, Nancy, who writes, I don't know what's been keeping you up at 3 in the morning, but what's been keeping me up for months are all the voter suppression tactics being used by Trump with approval by Republicans to fix the November election. I'm hoping you and Ann will address in an upcoming segment the various permutations of the strategy, including the administration's recent actions with respect to the Postal Service. And so I think that that's the right context of there are a lot of things happening with voting. We've talked about a bunch of them. And today we should talk about the Postal Service and what's happening there. Because to your point, Preet, there's been no transparency around the reasons why a lot of changes have been made. But also, let's just be honest, a lot of changes have been made. There's a lot that's happened there in the past since the new Postmaster General took over on June 15th.
Why don't we talk about some of those things? So among the things that are happening are there have been lots of mailboxes removed. There are pictures that have been posted on social media showing the very well-known blue mailboxes sitting on trucks being taken away. Sorting machines, high-speed sorting machines to the tune of 671 have been decommissioned, whatever that means. There have been moves to cut overtime, which means that some mail will also be delayed. There has been a reshuffling by the Postmaster General of something like 23 executives at the Postal Service. And there are other things. I'm sure I've forgotten a few. And the question is, are those nefarious? Are those in service of trying to slow down the mail generally, because the Postal Service is going to be key in making sure that the mail-in ballots that you spoke about will get to their destinations on time, or not? And it may be true, by the way, as we were discussing before we started taping, that some of these may be malicious, some of these may not be malicious. There's just no transparency, so it's impossible to know fully. What we do know is that the President of the United States has made it very clear that he hates the idea of mail-in voting. He draws a false distinction between absentee ballots and general mail-in ballots, including in Florida, where President Trump will be voting by mail, incidentally. And he's on record as essentially saying that he wants to keep the post office kind of down so that they can't accomplish the goal. Here's a quote from an interview with him last Thursday on Fox Business. He goes on to complain about how much the post office wants. They want this. They want billions for this. They want billions for that. And he says,
they need that money in order to have the post office work so it can take all of these millions and millions of ballots. Now, if we don't make a deal, that means they don't get the money. That means they can't have universal mail-in voting. They just can't have it.
Isn't that a very clear statement of intent to keep money away from the post office for purposes of the election?
To your point earlier also of there's just a lot of things. I mean, I sort of feel like if it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it probably is a duck. And so that's why I think people are alarmed.
Penguins are going to be very unhappy that you have picked a duck.
If it waddles like a penguin, and I forget the noise that penguins make. I won't do it. Then it is a penguin.
If it quacks like a penguin, then it's a duck. If it quacks like a penguin, then it's still a duck. I think that doesn't work.
So I think we have to look at all these things together. If we isolate them one by one, we could probably come up with an explanation for it, or the president could come up with an explanation for it. But when you look at it all together, and then you have the president's quote, that quote kind of says it all. And I really liked a tweet that Joyce Vance put out where she basically said, one of the things that's new here is that the president said the quiet part out loud. If the mail is on time, people will get to vote safely. If the mail's not on time, if we don't give the post office additional money, people won't get to vote. Or they'll have to make a choice between do they risk their own health or do they vote? So I think that this is a really important piece, because how do you know someone's intent? You know it from their actions and from their words. And the president's words are very, very damning here. Can we talk about Mark Meadows also?
Yeah.
Because Mark Meadows, the White House chief of staff, he's asked by Jake Tapper, you know, what's happening here? Like, what's happening with the post office? And Tapper was aggressive in questioning him.
But there's no evidence of widespread voter fraud.
There's no evidence that there's not either. That's the definition of fraud.
Right? It's like
we would have had a tremendous conviction rate if we could argue to the jury there's no evidence that he didn't commit the crime.
Exactly. Right. And it's that's not the way the system works. The onus now is on Trump to prove fraud if he wants to change how states have decided to allow their citizens to vote.
As a general principle of logic and persuasion, the burden falls upon the person who is making the claim, right? It doesn't fall upon the other party.
Yes. And I think that's just worth pointing out, because I think a lot of these conversations about the post office and the fraud, both when you take the president's own statement about the funding, and then you take it in the context of Mark Meadows basically trying to sort of do this bizarre burden shifting of that, you know, in order for people to vote according to state laws allowing them to vote in a certain way, they have to prove that there won't be fraud. I mean, it just defies logic. And I think it also, you know, it shows sort of an intent to harm or interfere with allowing people to vote easily and consistently with state laws. And by the way, again, that's on top of a complicated thing already.
Look, some people are pointing out, and I'm not an expert on the Postal Service, although I've become a little bit more over the last 4 days. They point out that, look, the Postal Service is able to handle huge spikes and surges in mail. For example, in the week before Christmas, you know, a billion plus pieces of mail, including, you know, more difficult to deliver things like packages, and they handle it. That gives, I guess, some small comfort that maybe they could handle what would probably be a smaller surge in the week or weeks before the election, but not in combination with the cutting of overtime, the cutting of personnel, and all sorts of other things. So, you know, there are some reasons I just want to put out there. I think everyone should be concerned and everyone should be happy there's going to be a hearing and there's going to be a lot of scrutiny on this. But there is some basis to think that it will be okay, so long as we are very watchful and very vigilant in making sure that further things don't happen. And I should also point out, some of these changes that were made before Louis DeJoy came into office, and some of them may have been planned for a period of time. It's just the perfect storm is the combination of all these things that look like they're aimed at and will have the effect of slowing down the mail, combined with the president's statements and the looming election, is a decent basis to be really concerned, if not panicked.
Well, here's another decent basis, which is that the Postal Service sent letters to 46 states that mail may be delayed and that people who want to vote may be disenfranchised. But there are a couple of pieces about that letter that I think are worth just highlighting. One is the specific language where they basically said that deadlines for ballots getting in are, quote, incongruous with Postal Service delivery standards, meaning that people are going to ask for mail-in ballots. It's now taking longer, and they're saying first-class mail is taking 2 to 5 days. Domestic marketing mail, which if you ask for an absentee ballot, sometimes absentee ballots are sent to you by domestic marketing mail. That takes 3 to 10 days. It's sort of less quick, that service. And then individuals send their mail back by first-class mail, again, which is the 2 to 5 days. And so in some ways, they're basically saying on its face, look, the mail is going to be a problem here. And they're flagging this in advance. And they're saying, mail your ballot by Tuesday, October 27th to make sure it gets counted, and mail it first-class mail. So there's a way in which there's this sort of warning going out. But there's another way in which it really is they're admitting to all these delays, and they're sort of saying, like, you know, to quote Donald Trump and now Michelle Obama, it is what it is, you know, get over it, right? Like, the mail is just going to be bad and you can't count on it. And we're talking about this in the context of voting, but we should also remember that, you know, things that people get by mail, particularly in a pandemic, medicine, food supplies. I mean, there's a lot that's
social
passing
security
back
checks.
Social security checks. There's
tens
a lot.
And tens of thousands of people get their social security checks.
Let me ask you this
their
question,
livelihood
Preet.
That way. Yeah.
If Donald Trump, we talked about the executive order and the memorandums last week. If Donald Trump writes a check to American citizens that, of course, he will sign right before the election, will that get to people in time, or will that also be delayed?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. Then I think he would figure out some way, because he's, you know, ingenious this way. Well, those things are okay, and those things will get out on time, but the other stuff not. I'm always amazed and floored by the ways in which he can draw distinctions like that, but I would guess he would be able to do that in some way.
Let's talk about the money a little bit, too, because I found there was a lot of conversations about the post offices going bankrupt, and the Democrats in Congress have wanted the Postal Service to get access to billions of dollars to facilitate mail-in voting. And that money, you know, they got $10 billion in the prior CARES Act authorization to borrow from Treasury, that they could borrow $10 billion. But Treasury is now refusing to turn that over unless the Postal Service agrees to some terms that would essentially give a lot of control over their operation to Treasury. I don't know what you make of that, but it does sort of feel like there's a lot of pieces moving here, all of which lead up to a very strong conclusion in my mind that if people want to vote by mail, they really have to do it early. That as important as it is for Congress to push back, and I think we should talk about what Congress is doing, there's so many pieces moving here that I feel like we all have to just be really careful in when we post our votes.
Yeah, look, and with respect to the funding, a couple of things are true at the same time. One, as people keep saying, the post office is in trouble financially. One of the reasons, as people may have heard and seen and read, that the Postal Service is not in great shape is it has a unique burden on it, financial burden on it, insofar as the Congress decided in 2006, when, Ann, you and I were both serving in the Congress, so maybe it's our fault. No, it's not our fault. In 2006, decided that the Postal Service uniquely had to fund its pension obligations 75 years into the future, so another 50 or 51 years from now. No other corporation that I'm aware of or government agency is subject to such a burden. That takes a toll. It's also true that there has been a diminishment in the number of letters and flat pieces of mail that provide revenue to the Postal Service. That's gone down, so that's been a problem. And during the pandemic, of course, there have been less mail, but there are more packages, but you know, those circulars and commercial advertising kinds of things that get sent in the mail are down, if not close to zero. So I think it's a little bit of a loss or maybe a wash. And then people point out, well, the Postal Service is in fact a service. It's not a business. And I've seen people online make the point, which is a decent, credible, legitimate point, that, well, by that measure, the military loses a lot of money too. Lots of other things in the country lose money. And you can't expect people, particularly in rural areas, many of whom might be Trump voters, to survive without the Postal Service, because they need medicine, they need to be able to keep in contact with people, they get Social Security checks, as we mentioned. So there is some argument that it should be government subsidized. It's not just paid for by the stamps you buy. That, I think, is a good and legitimate point. Although it is the case that for large portions of its history, the Postal Service has generally been independently able to function financially. So the question is, now that it's on hard times, why would a president, given the value of the Postal Service and the bipartisan support over the course of two centuries for the Postal Service, it's the most respected and, I think, liked institution of government. Why would you try to destroy it? And the reason is because he sees an election looming. All roads lead back to the re-election and what is going through Trump's head. By the way, the other thing that's interesting about it is, I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, Trump has basically changed the perception of people about how they should vote. You would think that it would not fall down on partisan lines. But the most recent poll I saw suggests that at the moment, Republicans are now much less likely to vote by mail, largely presumably because of what the president has been saying, and Democrats are largely inclined to vote by mail. So the other thing that the president has accomplished is causing, whatever you might think, whatever solutions are available for the Postal Service, Trump has succeeded once again in doing what he does in other areas, and that is to cast doubt. To cast doubt. Now, people don't know, is your vote going to matter? Is your vote going to get in because the ballot's not going to get in on time? Is there going to be fraud in connection with mail-in votes? It's both trying to deplete the Postal Service. It's also, in part, to deplete people's trust in whatever happens. And that may be just as bad as what he's doing to the Postal Service.
Well, there's another piece, too, having done some election work, you know, election day work. The number one goal when you do election work, and you do it for a political party, I did it during the John Corzine's election, his first election as when he was running for governor of New Jersey. And what you are taught as a sort of election day lawyer is that the number one, the ideal is to get somebody to vote in the voting booth, to get that vote cast in the voting booth, because it has the greatest likelihood of being counted. Now, that's, it doesn't mean in any way that mail-in votes or absentee ballot votes are not counted. In this election, if you have 60% of all the votes being cast that way, I think that completely changes this analysis. But I don't want to ignore the fact that if there's litigation, there will be more litigation around those ballots. When were they postmarked? Are they filled out correctly? Are they legible? Is it easy for you to read? Do you know who the voting, who the vote was cast for? And so there's a way in which this may be a part of the president's goal. Again, I think part of what's happening here is we're also just switching to this new form of voting, which is I plan to vote by mail.
Well, it's not new
mail.
For everyone. It's new for some.
Yes,
but
agreed.
It has been done for a long time in a lot of states, including Oregon and Washington and elsewhere.
Yes, and it works. And it's worked in those states. And I have voted by absentee ballot before when I've been away. I intend to vote by mail this year because of the health issues and COVID-19. But I do think it's important to sort of just highlight what you're talking about is the political nature of this. It's not a coincidence that this is happening August before the November election. What you were talking about is, you know, removing mailboxes. They've stopped overtime for the Postal Service. They've stopped allowing mail carriers to go out repeatedly, right? So if there's a lot of mail, they might take two trips instead of just one. They've stopped that. They've stopped sorting machines, these sort of 600 plus sorting machines that sort 35,000 pieces of mail per hour. They've started to remove some mailboxes. Like when you put all of that together, you know what you do when you talk about Christmas, when they have billions of pieces of mail, you know what you do when you have more mail coming? You add resources, you add overtime, you run extra shifts, you don't cut them. And so you basically, you know, everybody who's done operations or logistics knows how to operate around short-term need. That's what this is. And they're doing the exact opposite of what anyone in these circumstances would and should do. And so I think it's just worth noting.
Yeah. So even if there's a legitimate basis to try to increase the solvency of the Postal Service, whether that's a pretext or not, it's going to have a devastating consequence potentially for the election. And here's the other thing, just further to what you were saying about what happens post-election and something that I've seen people talk about in the last day or two. The president has done something else, right? The president has said the election should be decided on November 3rd. And that's the most accurate picture of what the voting has been. You don't want to wait days. You don't want to wait weeks. He sometimes says, we may not know for years. If you have a skew that's dramatic in which people vote by mail and which people don't, you could have a circumstance in which in one or more states, by the end of election evening, it looks like Trump is winning in a particular state. Because overwhelmingly, his voters, hypothetically, have voted in person, and those get counted right away. And then the mail-in votes take a few days to count. And it may look like, for example, he's won in Pennsylvania or he's won in Wisconsin by like 5 points. But at the end of the day or at the end of the time that they count the votes, he loses by 5 points. But he is going to use the snapshot of election day to say, I won. I won.
And
the
election
state
is now being stolen from me. That's exactly 100%. The narrative. Yes.
And he's already created that perception. And we're still something like 77 days away from it. Think of how much he's going to bang that drum day after day after day.
So why don't state legislatures pass laws today that allow for early counting of absentee ballots and allow, you know, people to return them? I mean, right now they're scheduled, I think, to go out at the end of September, but, and maybe logistically it's hard to get them out earlier, but, you know, get them out as soon as they can, allow counting as soon as they come back. And then you may not have, I mean, if the split really is 40% of the people vote in the voting booths and 60% vote by mail, you may not have counted 60% by election day, but maybe you've counted 40%. So at least there's there's a little bit less of this lopsided appearance, because you're exactly right that if Trump succeeds in getting his voters to the voting machines and Biden gets all his voters to vote by mail, you're in a position where it's going to, when you're defending, you're losing, right? And so Trump will declare victory on Election Day, and then it will be this conversation of taking it, changing that, which will be completely legitimate given the rules that the states have come out with. But it's going to be a problem, and it's a perception problem. And again, I believe that the delay benefits the president, right? So that the longer it takes to call the election, the more the more opportunity the president has to convince people that there is fraud or that there's wrongdoing or that he won and he's being cheated, versus the truth, which would probably be that he was seeking to cheat or to take advantage of the timing to make it look like he won. And I'm not saying he's cheating. I'm just saying that, like, that time period will give him an opportunity to sort of accuse others of things that are not true. And by the way, he may cheat. I'm not saying he won't. My sort of bigger point is that it just creates this opportunity and this opening for all these problems that will generally inure to the benefit of the president.
So we've been talking about all the reasons why we think and are worried that some of the things going on at the post office are not kosher and are problematic. One is just the fact of the things going on, the looming election, what the president has said. And we haven't really focused yet on the Postmaster General himself, who, as you said, started on June 15th, and why his background and affiliations are cause for concern that this is not on the up and up also. It's Louis DeJoy.
Before we get there, one last point on the president and the Postal Service, which is that I think we should all be asking the question of why in the June before the 2020 election has the president and his Postmaster General finally decided to address all the issues that may exist at the post office. Whether they're, you know, I'm not in any way questioning that there are financial problems, that, you know, there are solvency issues as to whether or not they can afford to stay afloat the way they're doing business today. But now is not the time. The president has had more than 3.5 years to do this, and he hasn't done it. So I just want to note, I'm not really objecting to making changes in the post office or efficiency or looking at operations, but now is not the time.
It could be quote unquote innocent insofar as you get a guy who comes in, he does not have experience in the Postal Service, but he's got experience in logistics, and that's the kind of business that he has been involved in. And he's a go-getter, hypothetically. He decides he's going to do all these things because he's trying to, you know, preserve the solvency of the Postal Service. I guess, you know, you could give that benefit of the doubt in normal circumstances, and to a different president and to a different administration. You just can't do it here. This is the same president who had to get impeached because of the nature of his contacts with the president of Ukraine, the president who had to have a special counsel appointed because of the nature of his attempts to obstruct justice and potentially collude. So this is a president who time and time again, for purposes of personal electoral success, engages in bad conduct and tramples on institutions and tramples on norms. So, you know, 3.5 years in, we've learned the lesson not to give the benefit of the doubt to people, even if they're operating in a way that in a different circumstance would have been okay. That's why I didn't return the call of the president of the United States, right? Going back to the way beginning of the administration. Maybe a different president at a different time, you wouldn't have the same concern. With this president, every single thing he does, every single thing he says, every lie he tells causes you to question everything that's going on. And when it's something as important as the upcoming election, we have no choice but to be worried about it. And so going back to Louis DeJoy, he's the first person, I believe, in 2 decades who has ascended to the Postmaster General position without having spent any time in the Postal Service. He is a huge donor to the campaign of Donald Trump. Now, that happens. There are other positions, ambassadorships, and I think that's not a good thing when Democrats do it or when Republicans do it, to give, you know, big government jobs to people who have donated in a massive way.
But this is also massive. Let's pause on that, because when we talk about people giving donations, sometimes, you know, you and I track the money and it'll be $20,000 or $40,000. Even the mega bundlers usually bundle about $100,000 for presidential candidates. That puts you in the upper echelon of fundraisers. Louis DeJoy has given $1.2 million to Trump and his campaigns since 2016, and he has given $1.3 million to the Republican Party. That is a lot of money. It's a lot of money. His wife is now being considered for an ambassador. I say this only because you talked about people buying their way to ambassadorships. His wife's being considered to be the ambassador to Canada. Sorry, Canada. But this
is
the way.
Is she allowed to go there? Like, she becomes the ambassador. I think Canada is not letting us Americans in at the moment.
Yeah, that's a good question. But really, it's a lot of Americans are have they have been allowed to go. They just have to quarantine for 14 days, and the Canadian government is really strict on it. But the bigger point is, it's not just like you're talking about him as a big donor. Like, he's a mega donor. He's in a league of a very small number of people. So he is a huge supporter of the president's. And again, you're right. He ran a logistics company, a trucking company that did national trucking. So that background is something where you would usually look at and say, well, logistics is essential to the Postal Service. But then you put that up against his sort of personal connections to the president and what he's done since he came in office. And I think that's what and also let's talk about his financials, too. What do you make of all that?
Well, I'll get that in 1 second. But the relevance of this thing that we're discussing is that it puts him on the same page and in alignment with the president with respect to reelection. And by the way, you know, people are fond of using this phrase, and I am, too. You know, two things can be true at once. It is sometimes the case that a thing that might be good for the post office in the long run is also in a nefarious way good for a presidential election. And sometimes you take cover from the fact that you can have a pretext and you can have an arguably legitimate reason for doing something, but the real reason you're doing it is to help the president win election or something else. We saw that when Jim Comey was fired, right? Rod Rosenstein was essentially made and persuaded to write a memo saying that what Jim Comey had done wrong was not treat Hillary Clinton well. And they tried to put that forward as a reason why the FBI director should be removed from his job. Nobody in their right mind thinks that Jim Comey was fired because he didn't treat Hillary Clinton well. So this, and we've seen it in the Supreme Court. You and I have discussed on multiple occasions that the Supreme Court has slapped down this administration because they claim to be able to do something for pretextual reasons, whether it's the ACA or something else. This is another example of that.
Let me give you a specific example of this, Preet. What DeJoy is going to say when asked about cutting overtime and not allowing postal carriers to go out on multiple runs during the day, which is basically how they're delivering the mail, he's going to say that the costs are out of control, that there's a need to basically improve efficiency. And he's going to sort of argue very strongly against, like, he's going to basically argue that there's overtime abuse, I think, and that there's that the sort of postal service has gotten used to functioning in a way where they always go out multiple times, they always have overtime, and so on. Now, there's an argument that they should do efficiency studies, that they should look at how many letters is it reasonable to deliver, what should take one round of delivery, what should take another, when should we have overtime and when should we not. That on its face would be a legitimate study to conduct and a legitimate question to ask, right? If every single shift requires overtime, then have we not hired enough postal carriers or are we not being efficient? Like, why is that? That's not what they've done here. He just came in and cut overtime and cut the multiple deliveries. But again, there'll be a pretext of efficiency, right? That like the post office can be more efficient. One of the reasons we're running out of money is efficiency. Again, it fits in with your example because it's clear that that's not what this is about. It looks to me like he would have studied that more carefully, but he's going to have the ability to claim that there's a legitimate reason for it.
And the other reason we know it is that there's a pretty simple way of helping the post office. And that is to agree with the people in Congress who say, help fund the post office with these billions of dollars, which the president has rejected and explicitly rejected, as we recited, because it would help the post office do mail-in ballots. So it's very circular. It all goes around and around and comes back to the president's own statements.
And can we talk about the financial conflicts around DeJoy as well? Because this also troubles me. And this has become almost also the norm for you and I having conversations about individuals in government or senators, people basically using their positions in ways that they shouldn't. And here, DeJoy and his wife, they have retained a significant investment in the company that his prior company was bought by a company named XPO. He had run a trucking logistics company that was bought by XPO. He and his wife hold between $30 and $75 million in investments in that company and other companies that do business with or that compete with the U.S. Postal Service. So they also have bought shares in Amazon. They've bought shares, I think, in UPS. And he is not divested, meaning he's kept his interest in those companies. And this is a complicated thing because the federal ethics officials that are currently in the Trump administration have said that's okay. Prior ethics folks say no way is that okay. You know, there's clear laws, there's crimes, you can't be involved in anything that's remotely self-dealing. But no matter how you slice it,
there's a huge appearance problem.
Exactly.
Here's a guy who has not a small investment or a mutual fund, but as you say, tens of millions of dollars in a company that is in fact a contractor with the agency in government that he runs. I mean, I'm not aware of something that's more clear than that. And whether or not you get a certain opinion from ethics folks, why you would allow yourself to be put in that position, especially when scrutiny is now upon you, and especially when people are questioning all the things you're doing, whether they're in the service of Donald Trump's reelection or not, I find it baffling.
Yeah, I agree. And look, if the price of stamps goes up, which it does at different points in time, will it be because that's the money that's needed to run the Postal Service? Or will it be because DeJoy has made a corrupt contract with one of these companies to in some way benefit himself personally? And so, you know, I'm not saying he has, but it's certainly there's zero benefit in holding those types of investments when you take these jobs. And he didn't have to take that job, right? So it's a totally legitimate thing to say, I have $75 million in investments in these businesses, and they both work for the Postal Service and they compete with the Postal Service. I don't want to get into that. That's fine. But once you take that job, to have that just like those overriding conflicts just feel to me like it really is a huge mistake. And whether or not it's criminal, some people have sort of alleged, well, it will be a crime if he gives a contract. And certainly there are criminal provisions against self-dealing. But the bigger issue here is that at this moment in time, like, why would they let him keep those investments?
So a lot of people ask the question, well, what can be done about this? And let's talk about some of the things. Now, one thing that people have begun to understand, I didn't know this until last week, the Postmaster General is appointed by the Board of Governors of the United States Postal Service, who are all at this moment white males, and we don't have a full complement of them either. And it's supposed to be the case that you have kind of what you have in other commissions, like the Federal Election Commission, you have one Democrat for every Republican, then you have the head of the organization who is of the party of the administration. But there have been vacancies for a long period of time. Barack Obama, for various reasons we can discuss if you want, wasn't able to fill the Board of Governors with the full complement of folks.
Well, we should just say Senator Sanders opposed.
There was opposition to some of these folks, and some of it for legitimate reasons, because some of the people being proposed, whether they're a Democrat or Republican, were in favor of privatization of the Postal Service and had other policy views that were not agreed with. But then all of a sudden Trump comes in and he stacks up the Board of Governors, the chairman of which
appointment. There are six members. They don't have the full complement of nine. There are now six members of the Board of Governors. All of them are Trump appointments, four R's, two D's.
Yeah, and the chair is another huge Trump donor, Republican donor. He, in fact, served as the chairman of the Republican National Committee from 2007 to 2009. Now, there are political people who get put in these jobs, but It's just another data point, right? You have the president talking about the election. You have the election looming. You have these actions taken. You have Louis DeJoy, who himself is a donor, aligned with the president. Now, the chairman of the Board of Governors also has those affiliations, and not, you know, modest affiliations, but really serious political affiliations and support of the president electorally. You know, every data point adds up and makes you wonder what can be done about this.
Yeah, and basically, I think Trump has a veto-proof majority right now. Because remember that the Postmaster General is a member of the board, and so Louis DeJoy is a member of the board as well. And so when you start to look at the odds of having anyone take action to rein him in or change some of the practices, I think it's not good, right? I mean, he may get pressure from Congress, and we should talk about that in a minute, to make changes. But the idea that there's real oversight right now of him on the Postal Service Board is just simply not true. I also think, and I don't think it's worth spending a lot of time on his inability to get members on the Postal Service or Sanders' opposition to it, But it does matter, right? It does matter. And sort of there's a reason that the terms for the Postal Service board members were 9 years and that they wanted it to largely be bipartisan with, as you say, the ability to sort of like switch the chair. And every year, one of the members is supposed to go off. And so there's a way in which it was set up to try to insulate a little bit from politics. But when, you know, parties block, particularly here, if, you know, President Obama was blocked by Senator Sanders and putting members on the board, it's one thing to oppose members. It's another thing to block anyone going on. And it leads to this type of a situation right now. And so, you know, I think it just strikes me as the perfect storm of problems and errors that are, some go way back, some go to how the Postal Service has been required to pay down their health care. You know, there's a lot of things that have gone wrong here, but it is, when you start to think about checks and balances and accountability, the first place, you know, you and I both look is the board, and then that's not the answer. At least here, it's not going to be the answer.
It's not going to be. And so let's talk about the couple of other things that may be the answer. One, Inspector General investigation. Two, what Congress has been trying to do. And then I guess three, there's been a call on the part of some folks for the FBI to get involved. Shall we go through those?
Sure.
First thing about the Inspector General, and I respect Inspectors General, as do you. The problem
with
all
of
these things, that's going to be true of almost everything we're about to discuss.
Yep.
In a different universe, if you didn't have an election 77 days away, which doesn't even do justice to how tight the timing is, if you're going to make a change in the mail-in voting, you're going to make a change in policies, you got to do it immediately. You can't do it on the 77th day. You got to do it, you know, right away. And in some places, maybe it's already too late. It's hard to turn around, you know, a gigantic ship. An Inspector General report takes usually, in the best case, months.
Yes.
Do you see any way in which any finding, whether it's credited or not, could be undertaken and put out in 77 days?
No.
Zero.
Zero.
So it's a
just
nice thing.
Zero.
But it's like an nice after-action report.
It is. It's a like what went wrong here, what should have been done, and all the findings will be largely.
It'll be entitled Why Donald Trump Was Reelected, Even Though He Shouldn't Have Been. And we can talk about that, you know, over a tall glass of vodka in December. But
yeah, I mean, look, I love Inspectors General. No, I love Inspectors General, but they're not the answer here. And so people keep calling in the Inspectors General. And look, they are institutional reviews of things that have happened. But in terms of stopping conduct or making an immediate change, they're not the answer. And
the one thing it can do in with normal people is cause a deterrent effect, right? So if you're running an agency and you know you're doing something that's not right, and all of a sudden the Inspector General announces that they're doing an investigation of your conduct, you might decide, oh, I better stop doing that. I better stop doing that thing that's causing the investigation, to in advance sort of thwart a bad finding, right? So you change things yourself. Look, and a little bit of that, we should be fair here, a little bit of that has happened. You know, there's been a huge outcry, and you and I are spending almost this entire show talking about this, which I'm not sure we would have expected a week ago. There has been an announcement from the Postal Service, I believe, that they're not removing any more mailboxes, whether they were for nefarious purposes or not. These things do have an effect. So again, in more fairness to the Inspector General, it can have that effect, but may not in this case.
But I don't necessarily credit that to the Inspector General. I credit that to huge public outcry.
Yeah, no. The only point I'm making
all over the news. Yes.
Like certain actions and outcry can sometimes have
outcry
an effect.
Outcry is very, 100%. It's just that you have the outcry, and that alone can have an influence. But the Inspector General, like, I just don't want people to think that something goes to the Inspector General and you've checked a box and it's going to be solved, right? It just, that's not the solve. But yes, you're right. The boxes, they stopped taking them, which was good because it was almost like a bad criminal cartoon that kids watch where, you know, the bad guy doesn't want people to vote, so loads up mailboxes into the back of a trunk in the
look, and I don't know enough to know if that's a standard operating procedure that happens, but we just didn't notice before because we had no reason to be concerned before. I read that mailboxes have been removed from places like Burbank, California, which are not necessarily part of a conspiracy to deprive Democrats of the vote. You know, those mailboxes have been removed from places where, if you believe in the nefariousness of all of this, it doesn't make total full sense. So maybe some of it was you know, things that were going to happen in the ordinary
course. Well, some of them have been removed from cities or at least moved within cities. And look, again, to your point, you can't give the benefit of the doubt because if you're going to move a mailbox from one street corner to another in a city at this moment in time before an election, it's you know, it can wait.
Knock it off. Knock it off.
Yeah. What do you make about the – so you and I went back and forth on this a little bit because Congress did what Congress always does when something comes up like this. They make these sort of generalized calls for we need answers and someone needs to come and explain it.
And it's then in a letter and a statement.
Yeah, exactly. And then initially they were like, great, we'll have a hearing in the middle of September.
Oh, my God. Carolyn Maloney sends a letter, yeah, saying we want to have Louis DeJoy testify on September 17th. And people, I think appropriately, kind of freaked out.
Yeah,
on Twitter and
I think
social
appropriately
media.
Like, too. It's yeah.
Why are you waiting till the middle of September?
Why don't you wait till November 1st?
So that was quickly rethought. Hearing. That was quickly I mean, within a day. So in fairness to Carolyn Maloney, I think for a lot of people, this reached urgent status in the last 3 or 4 days, and that request for testimony on September 17th, that invitation to come testify was made before this sort of latest round of concern. But still, if you want to have some meaningful, you know, reaction and ability to respond, you gotta make it sooner. And then so she did change the date to August 24th, which is 6 days from today when we're taping. And not just him, a couple of other people who were associated with the Postal Service as well. And I mean, I don't know what you thought. I wasn't sure he would agree to testify. You're used to people in this administration rejecting requests to testify and waiting for a subpoena and sometimes not even abiding by the subpoena. He has said he's coming.
Yes.
What's that going to be
like? I was glad
to
see that. Yeah, I was glad to see that. I think it's the right thing. I think the Postal Service, particularly at this moment in time, is just such an essential government function for all the reasons we talked about, not just voting. And so if he hadn't shown up, it just would feel to me like he shouldn't be sitting in that job because, again, like this is it's a really important American institution. So what is going to be like? I mean, I think he's going to come – I think he's going to come and he's going to argue things like I was just saying. He's going to argue, look, we're inefficient. We have too much overtime. It's being abused. And, you know, if the Democrats are ready to really go toe-to-toe with him, they're going to have to be prepared to fight through and really question him on every single excuse. It's like, okay, you know, you oppose overtime here. How do you feel about police overtime that the police union support? What have you done to do an efficiency study? What information do you have? How do you manage at Christmas? Like, talk us through how much money that costs to get through. Like, they really are going to have to be prepared because he's going to come prepared with facts and arguments as to why every single decision he's made was correct. And I think they have to basically both be able to put it in the context of timing and why now is not the time. Second, they should push him to do more for the election and for him personally to lobby the Senate Republicans and others in Congress to get money for the Postal Service. And third, be prepared to really go through every single argument he's going to make where he's going to come across, I think, as technocratic, as like with a strong command of the numbers, the personnel, the sort of budget, and be arguing like, look, it's a doomsday scenario for the post office. And if I don't do this, the Postal Service is going to go under, which I personally don't believe we're going to allow the U.S. Postal Service to go under. But
well, I'm
my
not
question
so sure about that.
But well, maybe under Trump. But my question for you is, how effective do you think they're going to be?
Well, it depends on who we're talking about. And I was going to ask you if you saw this tweet from Katie Porter, who writes in response to a post that Louis DeJoy is coming to testify. She writes, "I hope the Postmaster General comes prepared. I know I will," which is basically game
on. Can she
on.
Go first? Yeah. Can she go first and have everybody give her their time?
You know, I would like to see that, or, you know, maybe professional lawyers. So this is not the Judiciary Committee, which last time out in connection with the hearing where Bill Barr testified, this is the House Oversight Committee, which I think has, you know, some very potent questioners on it, including most notably, I think, Katie Porter. I mean,
yeah,
I think
she's
one of the most effective people on
the
Hill.
I feel the same.
Yeah, and asking questions. And she will have done her homework, and she knows how to use a five-minute round to great effect. So I think so to answer your question, I think it'll be more effective than we've seen in the recent past. And there's a lot riding on this, and I think people have seen the prior experiences have not gone well. And look, at the end of the day, what is the point here? There's legislation which we can discuss that's been proposed, which will probably not pass in the Senate. But the point is to show an outcry and to expose bad conduct or, you know, deliberate conduct to help President Trump win the election, which is not appropriate, ethical, or perhaps even lawful on the part of somebody in a non-political position like the head of the Postal Service. And you got to make your point. It's sort of a rhetorical battle. They're not going to get him to resign on the spot, but they can get him to commit to doing certain things, because being in the hot seat, you know, is not always as easy as it looks.
And I think the biggest point here is that people are losing faith in elections because of this in part, right? And obviously there's a lot going on, but that is a terrible thing if we allow that to take place. And so it needs to be fixed. And the Postal Service needs to do their part to make sure that the election is free and fair and that everyone gets the opportunity to vote. And so that should be bipartisan, that we should believe in, you know, the power to vote in America. And so I think that the congressional hearing can go a long way toward that argument as well. Now, I also think, Preet, and, you know, I always worry at these moments when things get really intense around one specific issue, that there are all these other things that we stop thinking about, particularly when it comes to things like Election Day. And so I think this is a really important point of focus, but I think it's just one of many ways in which we have to be on the lookout for problems with voting in November. It just obviously is sort of like come to the front of our attention because of the letter that DeJoy sent to the states, because of the president's statements, because of Mark Meadows' accusations, and then all these actions to sort of gut and undermine and make the post office really unable to deliver the ballots.
Then you have the possibility that people always want to look at because they love the idea of criminal prosecution for everything. You have, I think, two well-respected members of the House, Hakeem Jeffries and Ted Lieu, who have written a letter to the FBI urging them to, quote, evaluate whether Postmaster General Louis DeJoy or members of the Board of Governors of the U.S. Postal Service committed any crimes in light of nationwide delays and issues with the USPS, end quote. So they cite these two statutes. One is 18 United States Code 1701, which relates to obstruction of mails. And they also cite to 18 U.S. Code Section 595, which is interference by administrative employees of federal, state, or territorial governments, which basically says you can't use your official authority in government to sway an election or influence an election or affect an election for the presidency or for Congress. I think they actually left out a statute, for what it's worth, 18 U.S.C. 1703, which relates to delay of mail if you're a Postal Service employee. All of these, by the way, are misdemeanors. I think one of them is punishable by up to a year, another is punishable by up to 6 months, which is not to say it's not serious if there's a violation of this, but, you know, I wonder what you think. It's an interesting suggestion, and I've seen some people on television say, well, there's a clear violation of this law. And I do think, even though I'm a prosecutor, I do understand the limitations of prosecution and these criminal statutes. If you look at obstruction of mails generally, it says, whoever knowingly and willfully obstructs or retards the passage of the mail or any carrier or conveyance carrying the mail shall be fined under this title or imprisoned not more than 6 months or both, end quote. To make the argument that Louis DeJoy, by engaging in these practices and cutting overtime and doing things that you arguably could say are within his discretion as the leader of the organization, and equating that to what was intended by the statute here, as bad as you think it is, I don't think it flies. Do you?
Yeah, no. And I think part of what it's worth really getting folks to understand is that the mens rea requirement, that knowingly and willfully, you have to prove that it was this, that an act was deliberately done with the specific intent of violating the law. And so right now we have a lot that we can look at that feels like circumstantial evidence of interference with elections. And people will say, well, that's direct evidence. Yes, it's evidence of something happening that could hurt the election, but you still need to prove that DeJoy acted willfully to do it. So now if you had a cooperator, if you had someone come from inside the Postal Service, although I personally think that's now unlikely. Remember, he's reassigned basically all the executive leadership. We didn't talk about that much, but he moved out the sort of existing executive team and put in a new executive team. But if you had a cooperator come in and say, I sat in the room and DeJoy said, Trump needs to win this election, shut down the election, you know, shut down the sorting machines, then you could have proof of willfulness. But it's not going to be on its face, just knowing what we know. We don't have sufficient proof, in my view. Now, again, that's not to say that there could never be evidence of it. But right now, it's just, it appears to be, just as you and I have discussed, really a terrible thing to do. But that doesn't always mean it's a crime.
So, Anne, there's a lot going on. There's a lot of moving parts. The news changes every day, and different people are calling for different things, basically hourly. So we'll both watch the hearing next Monday. And the good news is that we will be here the very next day to break it down.
Yes. That's all I can really say. It's yes. True. We'll be here. We'll be here. And I'll be
affirmative.
Watching. And I'm going to try not to scream at my TV this time as I was reformatting the questions for members during the bar hearing. I'm going to try to, you know, I'm going to try to get my zen on for the postmaster hearing.
Obviously, there's a lot of other news that is going on, including things that have been said about the Durham probe, the U.S. attorney in Connecticut, looking at the origins of the Russia investigation. And we'll talk about that, too.
Yeah, and we should talk about that soon, because I think if anything's coming, it will come in the next couple weeks. And so we'll definitely have more to talk about next week and the weeks coming after.
And one final thing for everyone, given what we've been talking about today and we'll be talking about again next week, vote. Get your absentee ballot if you're permitted to in your state and return it as soon as you can.
By the way, I was looking last night during the Democratic convention. I watched the Michelle Obama speech. And at first I was like, what does her necklace say? And then I realized.
V-O-T-E.
Yes. Vote. Thanks, Preet.
Take care, Anne.
Talk to you soon. We'll be back next week. And everybody, continue to send us your comments and your questions to letters@cafe.com. And we'll do our best to answer them.
That's it for this week's Insider Podcast. Your hosts are Preet Bharara and Anne Milgram. The executive producer is Tamara Sepper. The senior audio producer is David Tatasciore. And the CAFE team is Matthew Billy, David Curlander, Sam Ozer-Staten, Calvin Lord, Noah Azulai, and Jeff Eisenman. Our music is by Andrew Dost. Thank you for being a part of the CAFE Insider community.